His Brother's Keeper, W.C. Tuttle, the Project Gutenberg ebook of His Brother's Keeper. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org if you are not located in the United States. You will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook, title, His Brother's Keeper, author, W.C. Tuttle, release date, May 31, 2025, ebook 76208, language, English, original publication, New York, Doubleday, Page & Co., 1928, other information and formats, www.gutenberg.org/ebook/76208, credits. Roger Frank and Sue Clark, asterisk start of the project GUTMBRG EBOOK His Brother's Keeper asterisk asterisk, Cowboy Scene, His Brother's Keeper, by W.C. Tuttle, author of Letters from a Homemade Cowboy, The Wages of Greed, etc. When the sheriff of CALOR started out into the Badlands after Red, Cowan men would have bet that he would get his man. But the Desert G.O.D.S. saw strange justice before the law was satisfied. It was always hot in the Bitter Water Valley, and the hills were like rumpled yellow and gray blankets shimmering in the summer sun. Folks didn't tan there, they simply charred. The winds were hot, even in the shade, when there was any wind. The old dirt road, inches deep in dust, wound in and out among the old lava beds like a long, yellow worm with its head in the town of Caller, its few tails ending at the scattered ranches. The valley was not a summer resort, and those who were financially able went into the far mountains to escape the heat. Along this winding, yellow road came a team and wagon, almost hidden in a cloud of dust, which drifted up from wheel and hoof like the smoke from a foundry stack. On the seat were a man and a woman, and in the back of the wagon was a single trunk, already dust-covered. The woman had a scarf twisted about her mouth and nose, while the man, face to his eyes, was covered with a bandana handkerchief, two masked figures, their dusty eyes blinking, red-rimmed. Their conversation was limited, had been limited for several weary miles, but now they struck a slight raise where the dust was less deep. "I had to do it, Joe," said the woman, as though picking up the conversation of an hour gone. "I just had to." "I know it, Mrs. Deming," said the man, nodding slowly. "I seen it, common," he spat dryly, still nodding. "I told him. I told him he was a fool, but," resignedly, "ya can't tell him nothing. Bullheaded as hell, Jim, is, he read me the riot act, said fur me to mind my own business. And he'll fire you, Joe." The man turned slowly and looked at the woman. She had removed the scarf now. Mrs. Jim Deming, wife of Jim Deming, sheriff of Caller, had been a pretty girl in her youth. She was still pretty, except that her hair was gray and her once smooth face was creased with deep lines. Her gray eyes were clouded with sadness as she looked at Joe Mills, her husband's deputy. Joe was tall, thin, harsh-faced, burned to the color of a dark Indian. Joe Mills was as hard as the lava beds, but he had found a man harder than he. Jim Deming, known as Duty Deming, was so hard that he rather appalled even Joe Mills. "Yeah, he'll fire me," agreed Joe slowly. "But that's fine, ma'am. I'm kinda sour on this county anyway. Seems to me that I'd kinda like to go somewhere else where there's green grass and lakes. If a loose lived here, you see, don't you worry about me, ma'am. You've got a plenty to worry about for yourself." "Thank you, Joe. I'm glad you don't blame me. It had to come. He wasn't so bad until they elected him sheriff. We got along, you know, going on to 3 years now. I hope they'd defeat him last election. Sure, probably been better if they had, but they say he's the best sheriff they ever had, I dunno. Because he sent my son to prison," she said painfully. "Yeah, it was his son, too. Oh, you know Harry wasn't a thief, don't ya?" "I don't reckon he was. The JB outfit started out to get Harry, and they got him." "His own father got him, you mean?" exclaimed Mrs. Deming. "Jim was alone when he found that evidence at Harry's place. It was nothing but a JB hide. Jim could have buried it and warned Harry. That hide was planted there by the JB. But Jim took the evidence and arrested Harry 10 years. It was Jim's evidence that sent my boy to the penitentiary." "Yes, ma'am." "And he sent Al Seymour up for stealing a horse, which he didn't steal. Al was drunk that night and got the wrong one. It was wrong for him to get drunk, I know, but he didn't intend to take the wrong horse. Jim knew it. Oh, yes, he did. But he went straight out and arrested Al instead of bringing the horse back. He could have explained it all. Al was no thief. He was going to marry Jane, wasn't he, Mrs. Deming?" "Yes, it broke her heart, Joe. I'm going to her now. Oh, I've pleaded. With Jim, talked and pleaded until my throat was raw. But what's the use? He defends himself by saying that he swore to uphold the law and both Harry and Al broke the law, his duty to the law. He sits in judgment on this whole desert, brags about his iron hand. Oh, it's iron, all right. It smashed his home, it will smash him too. I dunno, he's pretty hard, ma'am. I never knowed a man as hard as Jim, and I've knowed a lot of hard ones. His job is a religion with him. And someday it will raise up and kill him, gun and badge. His star is his God, said the deputy slowly. And don't the Bible say something about thou shalt have no other gods before me? Meb, I dunno much about the Bible. I don't reckon that God operates much around here, it's too hot. I've wondered about it, she said, wearily. I've prayed a lot, Joe, but nothing came of it. Too hot, Mrs. Deming. I don't reckon a fried prayer ever got any further than a fried egg. Meb not as far because yuh can eat the egg. Well, there's the town. Yuh've got plenty time cause the train ain't never on time. Lots of folks would miss the train if it ever came on time. The train was of the mixed variety, half passenger, half freight, a branch line train, using something like 7 hours to complete the 60-mile run from Santa Leone to Levering, which was 20 miles, south of Calais. Calais was the usual desert type of town, perhaps a little larger due to the fact that it was a county seat, but the buildings were unpainted, scourged by wind and sand, until they blended nicely with the gray of the desert. Two huge water tanks, thrusting their ungainly bulk upward, on their scaffolding like huge, rotund giants with spindling legs, supplied the town with water, which was always warm. The depot had once been painted a bright red, but time had dimmed its luster until it was a sickly pink where any color yet remained. The team came up to the depot platform, guided in close to the high platform. The deputy helped the woman down and unloaded the trunk. He tied both horses securely to the platform because they were unused to trains and then began twisting the trunk around to the front, the woman following him. The telegraph wires hummed in the hot wind and there was a strong odor of pitch frying up from the planks of the platform. A man stood near the doorway to the waiting room, a tall, lean figure of a man, harsh of feature, his gray eyes deep set under beetling brows and separated with a high-arched nose. His mouth was wide and thin-lipped. In raiment, he was practically the same as 99% of the desert men, well-worn sombrero, colorless shirt, stringy vest, overalls, from which the color had long since fled, tucked in the tops of high-heeled boots. Around his lean waist hung a belt and holstered gun, and on the lapel of his vest gleamed the insignia of office. Such was Duty Deming, Sheriff of Calais. He shot one sharp glance at his deputy, who handled the trunk awkwardly as he rolled it out near the edge of the platform. The woman stopped short and studied the face of her husband. You didn't think I'd come, did you? She asked. If I hadn't, I wouldn't be up here, he said slowly. The deputy walked from the trunk to the waiting room. He had Mrs. Deeming's ticket and was going to check the trunk. The sheriff's eyes followed him. You don't need to blame Joe, she said. His eyes shifted from the doorway and came back to her. You're not sorry? She asked. What for? I've got nothing to be sorry about. After 30 years, Jim? No, you said you'd go away. I've provided for ya all these years and sent my son to prison, drove my daughter away. His jaw set grimly for a moment. Well, I guess that's all, Jim. They were silent now. Came the soft humming of the rails as the train came creeping through the desert. The telegraph instrument in the office clanked spasmodically. They call you Duty, she said bitterly. And you're proud of it. You think more of that than you do of your family. Your evidence ruined the happiness of your daughter. Your evidence ruined my happiness, taking the oath. I swore to do my duty, he said slowly. I raised my right hand and swore to uphold the law. It doesn't mean that an officer can be lenient to anybody. I've been the best sheriff this county ever had, and I'll keep on being the best sheriff. The voters put their trust. I've heard all that, Jim. I'm going away now, going to be gone forever. I'll never come back to the desert to you. You've made a god of your job, Jim. Maybe they'll put up a monument to you someday. The train whistled shrilly as it came into view. The deputy came out and gave Mrs. Deming her ticket and her trunk check. Thank you, Joe, she said, holding out her hand. They shook hands and she turned her back on her husband, watching the train come in. There were only a few people at the station. The engine clanked past and the train ground to a stop. The sheriff's eyes were looking down the train, and without a word, he walked away from his wife and strode down the platform. She looked curiously after him, but he did not look back. So this was his goodbye. Stifling a sob, she climbed up the steps of the coach and went inside. While the agent's helper threw her trunk in the baggage car, Duty Deming walked down to a boxcar and hunched on his heels, speaking to a man who clung to the rods beneath the car. Come out of that, he ordered gruffly. The man slowly edged off the rods and almost fell headlong. His legs were cramped from the uncomfortable position, and he was black with dirt and sand, his clothes driven full of it. "Stealin' a ride, eh?" grunted the sheriff. The hobo straightened up, looked around through bloodshot eyes, which finally came back to the sheriff. The train was moving again. "What's the big idea?" asked the hobo hoarsely. "What right have you to drag me off here? You're just a hick sheriff, and this is a little town. I was just traveling." "Stealin' a ride," said the sheriff grimly. He did not look up as the coaches passed him. "You know it's agin the law, young man. That's up to the railroad company, or do you own this particular branch?" "No, I don't own the railroad," replied the sheriff harshly, "but I do represent the law around here." "Represent it, eh?" The hobo sighed deeply and looked at the passing coaches. The sheriff did not look at them. "Hot ridden under there," said the hobo. "I was just heading out of this country. Tough riding, I'll tell you, but they had all them boxcars sealed. Still, I could have made it to Levering." "Well, ya didn't," snapped the sheriff. "That's true. Still, you haven't any rock pile. All you can do is to put me in jail and feed me. That's not a profitable thing. Better let me sit here in the shade until the next train comes along. And let you steal another ride, eh? What do you care as long as you don't own the railroad?" "I'm paid to uphold the law," said the sheriff stiffly. The hobo sighed wearily as he scraped his heel against the cinders. "Do you always uphold the law?" "Always, that's what I'm here for. A little authority has made you your brother's keeper, eh?" "I'm the sheriff." "Oh, I can see that, but what right have you to haul me off that train? It isn't your train. You're not paid to guard that train, are you? Don't shove me, can't you see I'm a sick man?" "Sick man," sneered the sheriff. "Sick because I'm going to lock you up for a few days. Don't play possum with me." "I'm not playing possum, as you say, I'm sick." Sheriff and sick hobo. The man really looked sick in spite of his grimy face, but the sheriff twisted him around by the shoulder and started him toward the jail. Several persons, including the deputy, waited on the depot platform to see what the sheriff was going to do, and as the sheriff marched his prisoner past them, he told the deputy to come with him. The deputy followed down to the jail, where the hobo was locked behind the bars. The deputy made no comment, but followed the sheriff back to the office, where they sat down. "Said he was sick," remarked the sheriff disgustedly. "Looked sick," said the deputy wearily, fanning himself with his sombrero. The sheriff studied the lean face of his deputy for a length of time. "How did you happen to bring the old lady in today, Joe?" he asked. "She asked me to. I came past the ranch. I told her I'd take the team back and get my horse." She was common, anyway, as though to defend his position in the matter. "She was, eh? You never stopped to think that you were working for me, did ya? You waste a day bringing her in and waste another day in going back with that team. Do you think I'm paying you to use up time that way?" The deputy flushed slightly and his lips tightened. "I didn't know that you paid me anything, Deming. Ain't I paid by the county? I'm part of that county, Joe, the sheriff part of it. I hired ya, did I?" The deputy got slowly from his chair and put on his hat. "You hired me, Deming, but I'll be damned if you fire me. I quit right now." "All right, suit yourself." "I intend to, Deming. In fact, I intended to quit ya when I came down here. You never even told your wife goodbye, just walked away to arrest a hobo who wasn't doing you any harm. You're plum loco over duty, ain't ya? I'm scared of ya, Jim, honest, I am. Your wife said you was worshipin' that tin god on your vest, that sheriff star. I reckon ya are. She said something about it raisin' up and killin', ya, said something about what the Bible said about not having wrong gods. I don't sabe just what she meant, but I do sabe how she feels toward ya. Deming, you've gone crazy over duty to the law. It's all right to enforce the law, but you're just a damn fool over it. I knowed you was crazy when ya sent Harry to the pen. You didn't need to do it, and you know ya didn't. Oh, I'm glad I quit ya. Deming's face flushed hotly and he started to rise from his chair, but sank back heavily, a queer expression in his hard gray eyes. What did she mean by saying that it would rise up and kill me? He demanded. That's fool talk, women's talk. Nobody can scare me. I'm glad ya quit if ya feel the way ya do about me and your job. You didn't always fulfill your oath, Joe. Meb it's best that ya did quit. I'm going to be more particular in the next deputy I hire. There'll probably be two, said Joe. You'll have a hell of a time hearing a new man, cause everybody knows how hard ya are, Deming. Well, I'll pack my stuff and get out. All right, Joe, give me your star. And them cartridges in your belt belong to the county. Several days passed in which Deming was obliged to run the office alone, which meant that twice a day he must carry food to his prisoner against whom no formal complaint had been made. But the hobo was far too ill to care whether he had food or freedom. He spent most of the time on his cot, talking deliriously, and in the dim light of the little cell, the sheriff could see nothing wrong with the man, except a fever. but finally he called in the doctor, who was also the coroner, and he immediately pronounced it a malignant case of smallpox, quarantining the jail. He was minded to quarantine the sheriff, but while he was making up his mind just what to do, a cowboy, Slim DeLong, fairly tore up the street of Caller, bringing news of a murder. DeLong was fairly incoherent. Red Cowan, another cowboy working for the JB outfit, had murdered Al Mitchell, owner of the outfit, and had headed for the lava beds. DeLong, riding in at the ranch, had seen Red Cowan, riding away swiftly toward the lava bed country, and a few minutes later, he had found Mitchell lying on the front porch, shot through the heart. Mitchell was a big cattleman in that part of the country, and the sheriff's son had been sent to the penitentiary for stealing Mitchell cattle. The town was rather in an uproar over the murder, but the sheriff did not ask any of the cowboys to ride with him. He saddled his roan horse, tied a quantity of food to his saddle, filled a canteen, and headed for the lava bed country. He did not need help. He knew every inch of the lava bed country, although he did not know Red Cowan. Red had only been there a short time, and he had heard Joe speak of meeting him at the JB. Shortly after DeLong had delivered his message to the sheriff, DeLong imbibed a few drinks before starting back to the JB ranch with the coroner and several others who were going out there to bring the body to town. He happened to be riding a half-broke bronco, and in the flurry at the hitch rack as they were starting out, DeLong's horse bucked, wickedly throwing DeLong against one of the hitch rack posts. In the parlance of the range, it knocked DeLong flatter than a snake belly, and he was unable to get on his horse, so they half-carried, half-led him back to the saloon, where they left him propped up in a chair. The sheriff did not hurry his horse. He swung in west of the JB ranch and headed for the lava bed country, making no attempt to pick up the tracks of Red's horse. He knew that Red would cut straight through the lava beds and head for the Mesquite River country, 60 miles away, 60 miles of waterless waste, a broken mass of twisted lava, which seemed never to have cooled since those prehistoric days when it had been poured indiscriminately over the landscape. Man with horse. The sheriff felt reasonably certain that Red Cowan had started without any preparations for food or water, and would probably expect, at least, to find water. But there was no water in that part of the country. And a man must ride slowly, because the sharp lava would soon ruin the feet of his horse, unless the animal was allowed to make its own pace. Mile after mile, he plodded along, squinting his eyes against the glare of the sun, until he developed a queer sort of a headache, a dull throb in the back of his head, which caused him to wince at times. It bothered his eyes. He drank from his canteen, but the water did not seem to quench his thirst. His mouth felt dry a moment later, so he took another drink, which caused him a slight nausea. Must be the sun, he decided. Still, the idea did not seem so good, because he was used to the sun. It made him angry. After a while, he filled and lighted his pipe, but after the first few puffs of the pungent weed, he put the pipe in his pocket. Ahead of him stretched the interminable wastes of the lava beds, where the heat devils danced before his eyes, and he cursed them aloud as though they could heed his voice. Then it seemed as though he realized the utter absurdity of such things and cursed himself. The setting sun found the sheriff riding aimlessly. His eyes ached continuously now, and he had lost all desire to scan the country. But he was not going to turn back. He was following a murderer, a cold-blooded killer, and the law must be avenged. He felt a little better when the sun went down and the short desert twilight had blended with the night, a time in which the temperature drops swiftly from 115 in the shade to 60 in the dark. The sheriff had ridden away without any blankets, and now he shivered in a sudden chill, which seemed to crinkle his vertebrae. Queer thing, that chill. It rattled his teeth like castanets and increased his headache until every movement of the horse brought him fresh misery. So he dismounted, uncoiled his lariat, and picketed his horse. It was only after several minutes that he was able to summon enough energy to remove the saddle. Duty Deming was a sick man and knew it. He thought of saddling his horse and heading for Caller, but he had lost all sense of direction. The stars blurred in his eyes, and he flopped down beside his saddle, burying his aching head in his arms. It was possibly 2 hours later that the sheriff's horse nickered softly in the darkness, but the sheriff did not lift his head. Came the sound of a horse walking, and the bulky form of a horse and rider came in through the broken rocks, plainly visible by the light of the stars. The rider drew rein near the picketed horse, as though rather surprised to find a horse there. He dismounted and discovered the rope, speaking softly to the horse. He turned away and soon discovered the sheriff. "Sleepin' kinda heavy, ain't ya, pardner?" he asked in a soft, drawling voice, but the sheriff did not move. Coming in closer, the man scratched a match. He was of medium height, thin-faced, blue-eyed, dressed in a faded blue shirt, well-worn batwing, chaps, black Stetson. The light of the match glistened on the butt of a big Colt in the holster swinging at his thigh. As he removed his hat to shield the match, the light glistened on his copper-colored hair. He was Red Cowan, the murderer. He knelt down beside the sheriff and shook him by the shoulder. "Wake up, partner," he said softly, but the sheriff merely grunted and began mumbling deliriously. "Sick, eh?" muttered the red-headed one. "Funny, got a bad fever and he's plumb loco, and it's a long ways to a doctor. Just what'll I do next?" He squatted on his heels and rolled a cigarette. After due deliberation and another cigarette, he saddled the sheriff's horse. The sheriff was not easy to arouse, but he talked steadily, mumbling his words, swearing, and laughing foolishly, while Red Cowan swung him into the saddle and roped him on. He swayed forward, both arms dangling loosely, while Cowan mounted his own horse and picked up the lead rope. Cowan took his bearings from the North Star and started out, looking back at the humped figure of the sheriff swaying in the saddle. "Stay with her, partner," he grunted. "We'll make the old alkali spring. Ranch by morning, and Meb will find somebody there." And all through the night, they wended their way through the lava beds, and it was just about daybreak when they came out at an old tumble-down ranch house. The old building seemed about to fall down, the corrals were in bad repair, and only one fan was left on the old windmill, which creaked in the morning breeze. Down by the old stable was an alkali spring, where a few cattle, drifters from the herds in the Mesquite River ranges, came to drink. Red Cowan looked them over appraisingly. They meant fresh meat. He unroped the sheriff and lifted him to the ground, propping him against the wall while he went inside. The inside of the house was not as bad as the exterior, as it had been used by some cattlemen during a recent roundup. There was a roll of blankets, tightly wrapped in a tarpaulin, swinging from a rafter, while from a tightly closed box he took flour, baking powder, salt, sugar, beans, and some cans of vegetables and fruit. "Thought there might be a cache here," he said as he removed the provisions. He took down the bedroll and spread it out on one of the bunks before going out after the sheriff, whom he dragged in and put to bed. He looped the sheriff's belt around a bunk post, removed his clothes, and prepared a breakfast before attending to the horses. The sheriff was burning with fever, tossing his arms, mumbling incoherently all the while. After a breakfast in which the sheriff did not join him, Cowan brought a pail of the cold water to the house and proceeded to give the sheriff a sponge bath. This treatment seemed to soothe the sick man, and he dropped into a slumber, putting hopples on a horse. Cowan found an old pair of hopples, which he put on the sheriff's horse, and turned his own mount loose to forage. There was little to be done. Cowan did not want to leave the sick man long enough to go after a doctor, which would take at least 2 days, so there was only one thing for him to do, and that was to stay and see it through, hoping that someone might come along and lend them a hand. For the next 3 days and nights, he worked with the sheriff. There were no medicines of any kind, and it seemed to be a losing battle. He killed a steer and made beef broth, which the sheriff could not eat, gave him both cold and hot baths, worked over him like a mother over a child, and on the evening of the third day, the sheriff awoke, conscious, for the first time. After a period of deliberation, he remembered starting out after Red Cowan. Seated near the bed, his head in his hands, snoring loudly, was a red-headed man. The sheriff did not know any red-headed men. He was very weak, so he shut his eyes and tried to think. After a while, he heard the man move and opened his eyes. "That's better," said the redhead wearily. "Who are you?" asked the sheriff, and was surprised that his voice was so weak. "I'm Red Cowan." The sheriff closed his eyes quickly. "I guess I do know ya," he said slowly. "Meb not, I was with the JB a while. What's the matter with ya? Anyway, you've been here 3 days. 3 days? The sheriff's eyes popped open. Red told him all about it. "Didn't have no medicine," he explained. "Had to do the best I could. Know who I was? Saw your star. Yo were Deming of Caller, ain't ya? Yeah, I thought ya was. I've heard of ya. How'd ya happen to be out there in the lava beds?" The sheriff closed his eyes, thinking swiftly. Cowan must not know why he was out there. "I dunno," he said. "Took sick, must have ridden a long ways. You picketed your horse." "Oh, I wasn't plumb out until after, just awful sick." "You sure know how to be sick," grinned Cowan. "Do you feel like some eats?" The sheriff shook his head. "Better not talk anymore, partner. You've been pretty sick and it might fever ya up if ya talked much." That suited the sheriff. He didn't want to talk, he wanted to think. His eyes shifted to his belt and gun on the bunk post at the head of his bed, and he wondered if the gun was loaded. When Cowan went outside, he lifted a hand toward the gun, and as he did so, he glanced at his hand. He felt of his stubby face, and a look of horror spread over his face. "Smallpox," he exclaimed to himself. "That's what it is, all them little red specks. I got it from that damn hobo." Cowan came back into the house, but the sheriff did not tell him. He was afraid that Cowan might leave him in fear of the disease. Not exactly that he felt an immediate need of Cowan, but he wanted to take Cowan back a prisoner. "Still feeling pretty good?" asked Cowan as he busied himself around the stove. "I don't feel so good, Cowan." "Probably not. Can't expect to, but I reckon I've busted the fever. How about a little broth, eh?" "Not now." "Uh-huh, tomorrow morning, if you're feeling pretty good, I think I'll head for Mesquite River and send some folks in to take care of ya. You need a doctor pretty bad, and you'll need the right kind of food." That was not so good. The sheriff huddled down in bed, trying to think of some way to prevent Cowan from leaving. Just now his thoughts ran in circles because his head ached again. 10 minutes later, he was delirious again, and all that night Cowan had to use force to keep him in bed. He babbled of murderers, horse thieves, and of his own prowess as a sheriff. And in the light of the candle, Cowan saw the rash on the sheriff's hands and face. "Smallpox," grunted Cowan. "So that's what's the matter, eh? Lucky I've had a good dose of it. Tomorrow I'll tie him down and head for a doctor." It was daylight again before the sheriff became conscious. The fever had abated enough to allow him to realize and recognize again. Cowan's face was drawn and tired, his eyes red from lack of sleep. "Sane again, eh?" he grunted. "Well, you've sure been off your nut a plenty, pardner. Listen to me and get this straight. I'm going out and round up my bronc. You've got a sweet case of smallpox, which means you're going to be here meb a couple weeks. I can't stay all that time, so I'm heading for Mesquite River to get ya a doctor and a nurse." Man walking out the door. "Ya take her easy while I get my horse. Meb I better tie ya down, cause you might go wandering around and die out in the desert. Anyway, you're all right for a while and I'll see ya before I pull out. I'll leave plenty water such as it is where ya can reach it. But you've got to have plenty nursin' and the right kind of food." Red Cowan picked up his rope and went out, leaving the sheriff staring at the rafters, trying to force his mind to function properly. He didn't want Red Cowan to leave him. He had never failed to bring in his man, and if Red Cowan ever left that, his hand reached up weakly and drew the heavy Colt from the holster. It was fully loaded. The weight of it quickly tired his wrist, and he stared at his bloodless hand. The fever had sapped his strength badly, and he lay back wearily, cursing himself for a quitter. He was no match for Red Cowan now. Hadn't Cowan said something about tying him down? The sheriff tried to sit up. If Red Cowan tied him. "Get up, you fool," he told himself. "You're all right. Are you going to lie here and let a murderer escape? You are duty deming, Sheriff of Caller." With a superhuman effort, he managed to swing around on the bunk and get his feet over the edge, but toppled back where he lay breathing, heavily, gripping the gun in his right hand. He could feel the fever coming back, but he would not let that stop him. It was now or never. No thought of the future, only the present. The law must be served. He managed to reach the doorway where he went to his knees, blinking out at the sunlight. It dazzled his eyes until the tears ran down his cheeks, and he dropped his head to one knee, covering his eyes with his arm. "No other gods before me," he muttered. What did she mean? What would rise up and kill me? His fumbling fingers tried to locate his star, not realizing that he wore nothing but his underclothes. He laughed foolishly in the crook of his elbow. His mind was clouding again. "I can't die," he told himself. "It's my duty to live. I've got to live." He got slowly to his feet, fighting hard. "They'll hang him, hang Red Cowan, eye for an eye. The law demands that. I'm the law of Caller, ain't I? Don't the law demand his life?" The sheriff sagged wearily, gripping the side of the door with his left hand. "I'm the law," he muttered drunkenly. "I demand." The fever cloud was enveloping him again, and the little blue devils, with their sledges, were beating on his brain, trying to batter him into insensibility. Where was Red Cowan, he wondered? Where had he gone? He was obliged to use both hands to cock the Colt. Red Cowan. That was what he wanted, the man with the flame-colored hair. There was no gratitude for what Red had done for him, no thought of the days and nights of nursing. The law must be satisfied, and duty deming was the law. He went stumbling across the uneven ground, sagging at the knees, his head swinging from side to side, almost trailing the cocked revolver in his right hand, fighting all the while. Then he saw his quarry just at the corner of the old stable. It was Red Cowan looking at him. The big Colt swung up and his finger tightened on the trigger. The recoil jerked the gun from his hands and he almost fell. He did not look for the gun. One shot had been enough. He hunched one shoulder against the old stable wall, gasping for breath. The law had been satisfied. He closed his eyes for a moment. The devils were still, hammering on his brain, but above it all he could hear another sound, a thump, thump, thump of horses walking. Slowly he opened his eyes and tried to see what the blurred thing was. He knew it was a man on a horse, although his eyes did not register the figures. "Jim Deming," said a voice. "For God's sake, Jim." It was Joe Mills, the ex-deputy. "Don't ya know me, Jim?" he asked. "This is Joe Mills." "I know," whispered Deming. "Ya quit me." "Aw, forget that. We've been hunting all over the country for you, Jim, and I had to do my duty," whispered Deming. He lifted his right hand with a supreme effort and pointed a finger waveringly. "That's Red Cowan," he said. "You're crazy," blurted the deputy. "That ain't Red Cowan." For several moments, the sheriff did not move. His face twisted strangely. "You say that ain't Red Cowan?" he whispered hoarsely. "Of course not, you danged fool. Don't lie to me, Joe. My God, don't lie." "I ain't lying, Jim. You're crazy, I tell ya. Of course this ain't Red Cowan, I know Red." Cactus, for a moment the sheriff's head sagged heavily, but he swung himself away from the stable, started toward the house on uncertain legs, but collapsed, falling flat on his face. "Now, wouldn't that rasp ya?" snorted the deputy as he swung off his horse and walked over to the prostrate sheriff. He picked him up and took him to the shade, where he laid him on the ground. Something about the sheriff caused the deputy to make a quick examination. "I'll be totally darned," he said slowly. Then he turned his head and saw Red Cowan riding in from beyond the stable, riding a bareback horse and leading another. "Hello, Mills," yelled Cowan. "Where'd you come from?" "Seymour," said the ex-deputy, and Cowan rode up to him. "By golly, I thought I should have tied him down," said Cowan. "He's dead," said Mills slowly. "Dead? Whatcha know about that? I found him several nights ago, Plum. Flat over there in the lava beds. He was too sick to talk, so I brought him here. I've had one hell of a time nursing him, Joe. Got smallpox, I reckon." "Measles," said Joe. "Must have got him from a hobo he had in jail at Caller. Hobo almost died too. Didn't Deming tell ya what he was doing in the lava beds? Too sick, I guess. He was looking for you, Red. Wanted ya for the murder of Mitchell." "What?" "Fact. DeLong brought the news of it, and Deming started on your trail. But DeLong got throwed against a hitchrack post that morning, and it hurt him so bad he died that same afternoon. But before he died, he confessed to murdering old Mitchell himself. He just thought he'd put the deadwood on you because you quarreled with Mitchell before ya quit." Red Cowan laughed shortly. "So that was it, eh? Deming didn't mention it to me. Meb he was too sick. Probably. Too bad he didn't live longer, Red. DeLong confessed that. Mitchell hired him to plant evidence that sent Harry Deming to the pen. We'll have Harry out in a few days." "Well, I'll be danged. Queer, ain't it?" mused Joe, looking down at the body of the sheriff. His wife said that someday his star would rise up and kill him. She said he was mackin' a god out of his star. "I dunno, Red. Things have a queer way of working out. If he hadn't been so strong on duty, he'd never have taken that sick hobo off that train. Deming always had the idea of bein' his brother's keeper, you know. That's what I've heard. Duty they called him, didn't they?" "Yeah, awful set in his ways. I suppose we might as well start back with him." "Sure, might as well. Sorry I didn't rope him down, but he seemed to be all right when I left. Fever made his heart weak, I suppose. But he never told me he was after me, Joe." "He wouldn't. I can figure out where he got the measles, and I can figure out why he didn't tell ya what he was doing in the lava beds, but I'll be damned if I can figure out why he killed the Red Bull calf and said it was you. I didn't know about that, Joe. He must have been crazy." "Mm-mm-mm," said Joe slowly. "I suppose he was. Red, do ya believe in them 10 commandments? Never read any of them. What are they about?" "Everything. Must be good, eh? Worth reading. Get a rope and we'll take him home." Transcriber's note. This story appeared in the January 25, 1928 issue of Short Stories magazine. End of the project. GUTMBRG, EBOOK His Brother's Keeper asterisk asterisk. Updated editions will replace the previous one. The old editions will be renamed. Creating the works from print editions not protected by U.S. copyright. Law means that no one owns a United States copyright in these works. So the foundation, and you, can copy and distribute it in the United States without permission and without paying copyright royalties. Special rules set forth in the general terms of use part of this license apply to copying and distributing project. Gutenberg trademark electronic works to protect the project GUTMBRGTM concept and trademark. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark and may not be used if you charge for an ebook, except by following the terms of the trademark license, including paying royalties for use of the Project Gutenberg trademark. If you do not charge anything for copies of this ebook, complying with the trademark license is very easy. You may use this ebook for nearly any purpose, such as creation of derivative works, reports, performances, and research. Project. Gutenberg ebooks may be modified and printed and given away. You may do practically anything in the United States with ebooks not protected by U.S. copyright law. Redistribution is subject to the trademark license, especially commercial redistribution. Start. Full license. The full project GUTMBRGTM license. Please read this before you distribute or use this work to protect the Project Gutenberg trademark mission of promoting the free distribution of electronic works by using or distributing this work or any other work associated in any way with the phrase Project Gutenberg. You agree to comply with all the terms of the full Project Gutenberg license available with this file or online at www.gutenberg.org/license. Section 1. General Terms of Use and Redistributing Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. 1A. By reading or using any part of this Project Gutenberg electronic work, you indicate that you have read, understand, agree to, and accept all the terms of this license and intellectual property. Trademark Copyright Agreement. If you do not agree to abide by all the terms of this agreement, you must cease using and return or destroy all copies of Project Gutenberg electronic works in your possession. If you paid a fee for obtaining a copy of or access to a Project Gutenberg electronic work and you do not agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement, you may obtain a refund from the person or entity to whom you paid the fee as set forth in paragraph 1E8. 1B, Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark. It may only be used on or associated in any way with an electronic work by people who agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement. There are a few things that you can do with most Project Gutenberg electronic works, even without complying with the full terms of this agreement. C. Paragraph 1C below. There are a lot of things you can do with Project Gutenberg electronic works if you follow the terms of this agreement and help preserve free future access to Project Gutenberg electronic works. See paragraph 1E below 1C. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the foundation or PGLAF, owns a compilation copyright in the collection of Project Gutenberg electronic works. Nearly all the individual works in the collection are in the public domain in the United States. If an individual work is unprotected by copyright law in the United States and you are located in the United States, we do not claim a right to prevent you from copying, distributing, performing, displaying, or creating derivative works based on the work as long as all references to Project Gutenberg are removed. Of course, we hope that you will support the Project Gutenberg mission of promoting free access to electronic works by freely sharing Project Gutenberg works in compliance with the terms of this agreement for keeping the Project Gutenberg name associated with the work. You can easily comply with the terms of this agreement by keeping this work in the same format with its attached full Project Gutenberg license when you share it without charge with others. 1D. The copyright laws of the place where you are located also govern what you can do with this work. Copyright laws in most countries are in a constant state of change. If you are outside the United States, check the laws of your country in addition to the terms of this agreement before downloading, copying, displaying, performing, distributing, or creating derivative works based on this work or any other Project Gutenberg work. The foundation makes no representations concerning the copyright status of any work in any country other than the United States. 1E. Unless you have removed all references to Project Gutenberg, 1E1. The following sentence with active links to or other immediate access to the full Project Gutenberg license must appear prominently whenever any copy of a Project Gutenberg work, any work, on which the phrase Project Gutenberg appears or with which the phrase Project Gutenberg is associated is accessed, displayed, performed, viewed, copied, or distributed. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg trademark license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. 1E2. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is derived from texts not protected by U.S. copyright law, does not contain a notice indicating that it is posted with permission of the copyright holder, the work can be copied and distributed to anyone in the United States without paying any fees or charges. If you are redistributing or providing access to work with the phrase Project Gutenberg associated with or appearing on the work, you must comply either with the requirements of paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 or obtain permission for the use of the work and the Project Gutenberg trademark as set forth in paragraphs 1E8 or 1E9, 1E3. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is posted, with the permission of the copyright holder, your use and distribution must comply with both paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 and any additional terms imposed by the copyright holder. Additional terms will be linked to the Project Gutenberg license for all works posted with the permission of the copyright holder found at the beginning of this work, 1E4. Do not unlink or detach or remove the full Project Gutenberg license terms from this work or any files containing a part of this work or any other work associated with Project Gutenberg, 1E5. Do not copy, display, perform, distribute, or redistribute this electronic work or any part of this electronic work without prominently displaying the sentence set forth in paragraph 1E1 with active links or immediate access to the full terms of the Project Gutenberg license. 1E6. You may convert to and distribute this work in any binary, compressed, marked up, non-proprietary or proprietary form, including any word processing or hypertext form. However, if you provide access to or distribute copies of a Project Gutenberg work in a format other than plain vanilla ASCII or other format used in the official version posted on the official Project Gutenberg website, www.gutenberg.org, you must, at no additional cost, fee, or expense, to the user provide a copy, a means of exporting a copy, or a means of obtaining a copy upon request of the work in its original plain vanilla ASCII or other form. Any alternate format must include the full Project Gutenberg license as specified in paragraph 1E1-1E7. Do not charge a fee for access to, viewing, displaying, performing, copying, or distributing any Project Gutenberg works, unless you comply with paragraph 1E8 or 1E9. 1E8. You may charge a reasonable fee for copies of or providing access to or distributing Project Gutenberg electronic works, provided that you pay a royalty fee of 20% of the gross profits you derive from the use of Project Gutenberg works calculated using the method you already use to calculate your applicable taxes. The fee is owed to the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, but he has agreed to donate royalties under this paragraph to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Royalty payments must be paid within 60 days following each date on which you prepare or are legally required to prepare your periodic tax returns. Royalty payments should be clearly marked as such and sent to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation at the address specified in Section 4, Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. You provide a full refund of any money paid by a user who notifies you in writing or by email within 30 days of receipt that /he does not agree to the terms of the full Project Gutenberg trademark license. You must require such a user to return or destroy all copies of the works possessed in a physical medium and discontinue all use of and all access to other copies of Project Gutenberg trademark works. You provide, in accordance with paragraph 1F3, a full refund of any money paid for a work or a replacement copy if a defect in the electronic work is discovered and reported to you within 90 days of receipt of the work. You comply with all other terms of this agreement for free distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark works. 1E9. If you wish to charge a fee or distribute a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work or group of works on different terms than are set forth in this agreement, you must obtain permission in writing from the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the manager of the Project Gutenberg trademark. Contact the foundation as set forth in Section 3 below, 1F1F1. Project Gutenberg volunteers and employees expend considerable effort to identify, do copyright research on, transcribe, and proofread works not protected by U.S. copyright law in creating the Project Gutenberg trademark collection. Despite these efforts, Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works and the medium on which they may be stored may contain defects such as, but not limited to, incomplete, inaccurate, or corrupt data, transcription errors, a copyright or other, intellectual property infringement, a defective or damaged disk or other medium, a computer virus or computer codes that damage or cannot be read by your equipment. 1. F. 2. Limited warranty, disclaimer of DAMAGES, except for the right of replacement or refund described in paragraph 1F3, the project. Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the owner of the project. Gutenberg Trademark Trademark and any other party distributing a project. Gutenberg Trademark Electronic Work under this agreement, disclaim all liability to you for damages, costs, and expenses, including legal fees. You agree that you have no remedies for negligence, strict liability, breach of warranty, or breach of contract except those provided in paragraph 1F3. You agree that the foundation, THE, trademark owner, and any distributor under this agreement will not be liable to you for actual, direct, indirect, consequential, punitive or incidental damages, even if you give notice of the possibility of such damage. 1. F. 3. Limited right of replacement or refund. If you discover a defect in this electronic work within 90 days of receiving it, you can receive a refund of the money, if any, you paid for it by sending a written explanation to the person you received the work from. If you received the work on a physical medium, you must return the medium with your written explanation. The person or entity that provided you with the defective work may elect to provide a replacement copy in lieu of a refund. If you received the work electronically, the person or entity providing it to you may choose to give you a second opportunity to receive the work electronically in lieu of a refund. If the second copy is also defective, you may demand a refund in writing without further opportunities to fix the problem. 1. F. 4. Except for the limited right of replacement or refund set forth in paragraph 1F3, this work is provided to you as is with no other warranties of any kind, express or implied, including but not limited to warranties of merchantability or fitness for any purpose. 1. F5. Some states do not allow disclaimers of certain implied warranties or the exclusion or limitation of certain types of damages. If any disclaimer or limitation set forth in this agreement violates the law of the state applicable to this agreement, the agreement shall be interpreted to make the maximum disclaimer or limitation permitted by the applicable state law. The invalidity or unenforceability of any provision of this agreement shall not void the remaining provisions. 1. F6. Indemnity. You agree to indemnify and hold the foundation, the trademark owner, any agent or employee of the foundation, anyone providing copies of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works in accordance with this agreement, and any volunteers associated with the production, promotion, and distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works, harmless from all liability, costs, and expenses, including legal fees that arise directly or indirectly from any of the following which you do or cause to occur: a distribution of this or any Project Gutenberg work, b alteration, modification, or additions or deletions to any Project Gutenberg work, and c any defect you cause. Section 2. Information about the mission of Project Gutenberg. Project Gutenberg is synonymous with the free distribution of electronic works in formats readable by the widest variety of computers, including obsolete, old, middle-aged, and new computers. It exists because of the efforts of hundreds of volunteers and donations from people in all walks of life. Volunteers and financial support to provide volunteers with the assistance they need are critical to reaching Project Gutenberg goals and ensuring that the Project Gutenberg collection will remain freely available for generations to come. In 2001, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation was created to provide a secure and permanent future for Project Gutenberg and future generations. To learn more about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation and how your efforts and donations can help, see Sections 3 and 4 and the Foundation Information page at www.gutenberg.org. Section 3. Information about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation is a nonprofit, 501(c)(3) educational corporation organized under the laws of the State of Mississippi and granted tax-exempt status by the Internal Revenue Service. the foundation's EIN or federal tax identification. Number is 64622-1541. Contributions to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation are tax deductible to the full extent permitted by U.S. federal laws and your state's laws. The foundation's business office is located at 41 Watchung Plaza 516. Montclair NJ 7042, USA, plus 1-862-621-9288. Email contact links and up. To-date contact information can be found at the foundation's website, an official page at www.gutenberg.org/contact, section 4. Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Project Gutenberg trademark depends upon and cannot survive without widespread public support and donations to carry out its mission of increasing the number of public domain and licensed works that can be freely distributed in machine-readable form accessible by the widest array of equipment, including outdated equipment. Many small donations, $1 to $5,000, are particularly important to maintaining tax-exempt status with the IRS. The foundation is committed to complying with the laws regulating charities and charitable donations in all 50 states of the United States. Compliance requirements are not uniform, and it takes a considerable effort, much paperwork, and many fees to meet and keep up with these requirements. We do not solicit donations in locations where we have not received written confirmation of compliance. To send donations or determine the status of compliance for any particular state, visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. While we cannot and do not solicit contributions from states where we have not met the solicitation requirements, we know of no prohibition against accepting unsolicited donations from donors in such states who approach us with offers to donate. International donations are gratefully accepted, but we cannot make any statements concerning tax treatment of donations received from outside the United States. U.S. laws alone swamp our small staff. Please check the Project Gutenberg web pages for current donation methods and addresses. Donations are accepted in a number of other ways, including checks, online payments, and credit card donations. To donate, please visit www.gutenberg.org/donate, section 5. General information about Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. Professor Michael S. Hart was the originator of the Project Gutenberg concept of a library of electronic works that could be freely shared with anyone. For 40 years, he produced and distributed Project Gutenberg ebooks with only a loose network of volunteer support. Project Gutenberg ebooks are often created from several printed editions, all of which are confirmed as not protected by copyright in the U.S. unless a copyright notice is included. Thus, we do not necessarily keep ebooks in compliance with any particular paper edition. Most people start at our website, which has the main PG search facility, www.gutenberg.org. This website includes information about Project Gutenberg, including how to make donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, how to help produce our new ebooks, and how to subscribe to our email newsletter to hear about new ebooks.